Good morning. First case this morning is United States versus Boz. Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, sir.
Government? Appellant may argue.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Lieutenant Daniel Rosinski, and I represent the appellant, Corporal Nicholas Bass. Chief Judge Stuckey?
Is it Baz?
It's Bass, Your
Honor. Okay.
Could you please bring the microphone more down?
Yeah. Thank you.
Chief Judge Stuckey, respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes of my time. For
yes.
Rebuttal. Government's arguments on the assignments of error are inconsistent. On Daubert, it argues that the diatherics test is reliable and probative evidence of gonorrhea in a rectal swab from a prepubescent minor. But on the other hand, it argues that no one who elicited or created the test could have reasonably intended that this reliable and probative evidence of child sexual abuse be introduced at a later trial. The military judge did not resolve this inconsistency, and he abused his discretion on the first issue in finding the test result non-testimonial. He looked too narrowly at the process leading to the creation of the rectal swab, and he missed that both this process and the testing at diatherics show that the reasonable primary purpose of the test was evidentiary.
Counsel, why do you view the government's position as being in tension with one another? Wouldn't a medical doctor want something that is reliable and tested and so forth? Why is that inconsistent with...
Your Honor, it's inconsistent because it's saying that this test is such reliable and powerful evidence of gonorrhea in a rectal swab, and as Dr. Kafer herself acknowledged, she said that the test would be highly indicative of child abuse in her unredacted notes in the Joint Appendix at 334, and that if either test...
Now, is the test highly indicative of that, or the fact that the results of the test? If you've got a one-year-old testing positive for gonorrhea, why wouldn't that be highly indicative of sexual abuse?
Your Honor, it would be, and to answer your question about whether the medical purpose would resolve this, that may be possible in another case, but it's not possible on the facts of this case, which show that the primary purpose of the test was evidentiary. There may, even if there's a conceivable medical purpose, the question is whether what the primary purpose of the test was. And here,
but in terms of the primary purpose of the test, the mother brought in the child, not at the request of NCIS. In terms of social services, the medical doctor didn't have any interaction with social services or NCIS, decided that it was appropriate to have the child tested. So where's this primary purpose coming from?
Your Honor, the primary purpose comes from both the elicitation of the test and the testing done at diatherics. And just to make it clear, the military judge ignored these facts in his ruling as well, which was an abuse of discretion. NCIS and DSS were working together, as evidenced by the case agent's notes.
Where's the connection between that and what the medical doctor did? And if the medical doctor was really being motivated by an interest in having this introduced at a trial, why didn't the medical doctor conduct a forensic approach to this and something where this test was not really geared towards something that would be introduced at trial?
Your Honor, first on that, so the military judge did find that the mother knew that Corporal Bass had gonorrhea before going into the doctor, sent there. It's reasonable to assume that they discussed it, and the fact that the doctor ordered confirmatory testing, even when she didn't have to, as in United States v. Squire, the doctor could have just given antibiotics without having even done any testing at all.
Well, and after the whole thing was over, they tossed it. They didn't keep it. I mean, if you got an evidentiary purpose, wouldn't you think that that as a matter of prudence, you'd keep the thing?
Your Honor, that might have been the correct thing to do, but the doctor at diatherics who testified in motions said that they wouldn't have done anything differently had this been forensic, and the science would have changed. They would have used the same test had it been done for a forensic purpose. So the...
But isn't this, in terms of a medical doctor, if you're looking for evidence in, for the sake of argument, a stabbing case, and you're looking at forensics to determine whether there is blood spatter from someone else who might have been the perpetrator, there's inherently that forensic aspect to it. But here, if you're a medical doctor, you've got a one-year-old who is presenting with a sexually transmitted disease, doesn't the medical doctor have a medical purpose in ensuring that that child is not placed back into an environment where that child, if treated with antibiotics, as you mentioned, wouldn't be resubjected to that sexually transmitted infection?
Your Honor, that might be reasonable in a case with an unknown perpetrator, which is the fact pattern of other cases. But here, in Dr. Kafer's exam notes, she already knew that this was an allegation against the father, Corporal Bass, and she knew enough to direct that there was no that there was to be no further visitation between Corporal Bass and the child in this case. So the STD test was not needed to establish any of that, unlike other cases in which it may be needed to establish sexual abuse in the first place. And you have no physical evidence here of sexual abuse, unlike Sanders v. Commonwealth, the case the government cites primarily to try and argue that this was non-testimonial. Here, there were no symptoms in an otherwise clear exam. Antibiotics could have been given, as in United States v. Squire, in order to address any potential concerns with STDs. You have a doctor ordering a test that was not necessary, and then ordering a confirmatory test, which was even more unnecessary, showing the evidentiary purpose of obtaining any evidence on STDs at all.
Well,
When
you say that a further test was not necessary, I thought in the record it indicated that there's a recognition that this is not a dispositive test. It's now recognized that giving antibiotics, particularly to a young child, is not a not something that is done lightly. So why wouldn't a physician say, in a test such as this, where it's recognized that there are a significant number of false positives, why wouldn't the physician want to conduct another test to ensure that it's appropriate to go forward with the application of antibiotics?
Your Honor, I'd respectfully disagree based on what was done in the case that confirmatory test was medically necessary. If you look at what the other clinic, Carolina East, did, they gave the antibiotics before the confirmatory test was even administered. Of course, they ordered the wrong test and mishandled it, so there was never any confirmatory evidence. But they didn't need that test to give antibiotics. Like in Squire, it could have been done entirely preventatively.
Well, then now you've got me puzzled, because which way does that cut? If they just pump him full of antibiotics, then it seems like the purpose is wholly medical. And they pump him full of antibiotics, which probably blows out of the water any confirmatory testing, but may well be indicated medically. So if that's the case, then doesn't that make it sound like the purpose is medical and not evidentiary?
Your Honor, even if there's a partial medical purpose, the test is the primary purpose, and this court in United States v. Gardner recognized that.
Well, partial, but I repeat the question, which way does this cut? If they basically toss it off and pump the kid full of antibiotics, and don't keep any samples, and it, to me that sounds like medically motivated actions, not evidentiary actions.
Your Honor, that's looking at it from Diatherix's perspective. Looking at it from the lab
from
company's perspective.
From the Big Pharma's perspective?
Yes, Your Honor, and the fact that they tossed it off, you still see from Diatherix in the Dr. Hobbs' testimony about their manual that they do recognize the potential for litigation of this, that they said that this test should not be used for suspected child abuse cases. Now, they went ahead and ran it anyway, which they
should have done. Well, if it shouldn't be used for child abuse cases, then which way does that cut? They used something that shouldn't be used for child abuse cases, which makes it sound more and more like it was medically motivated.
Your Honor, respectfully, it shows that they recognized, as the CDC did, the risk of litigation coming from this positive sample. That they didn't follow their own procedures to avoid being put in this position is another matter that shows their careless handling of this, which is another reason why the confrontation rights.
Well, they may be a bunch of bumblers, but that's not for us to decide. What we've got to decide is whether this was motivated by a search for evidence or something else.
Well,
Your Honor, that's what the prior facts got to decide, and that's what we've got to review.
Your Honor, in Melendez-Diaz, the Supreme Court did say that catching the inept as well as the deceitful lab analyst is one of the purposes of confrontation, and you have exactly that situation here. You have a test that shouldn't have been run, that was run against the manual, and you have the government being able to put it on without the defense being able to confront any of the people involved in testing that sample, any of the ones who could have been confronted with their mistake.
Was your concern at trial that the test was running correctly or that the test was not reliable? I thought that the concern was that the test, regardless of how it was run, I thought your argument was that it was not reliable, that it should be excluded under Daubert.
The argument's both, Your Honor, both that the particular sample was mishandled and the witness who did testify from the government could speak to it violating their manual, but she didn't have any firsthand knowledge, not even as a supervisor, not reviewing the particular lab test in this case, to say what actually happened that resulted in the sample that shouldn't have been tested in the first place.
All this information was presented at trial, correct? On cross-examination, on direct examination, through your defense witness?
Your Honor, counsel did elicit the fact that the test shouldn't be run in the first place, but confrontation is designed to expose, by demeanor evidence, those who make mistakes, and this could just be the tip of the iceberg.
For testimonial evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. And the evidence is testimonial, where Diatherics knew that the sample was from a one-year-old. It was a rectal swab to be tested for gonorrhea and someone who can't
Is your argument that we look at the perspective of the person doing the testing or the person that submits the test?
Your Honor, the argument is both. It's whether the primary purpose of a reasonable person in the position of either was to create evidence. And that,
what case are you relying on for that?
Your Honor, that's Supreme Court case in Michigan v. Bryant, Ohio v. Clark, and looking at the guidance in Williams v. Illinois, where Justice Alito looked both at the Illinois state lab.
Ohio versus Clark doesn't quite say, but almost says, as long as it's submitted by someone other than law enforcement. I mean, it doesn't quite hold that, but if you look at the concurring opinions, they seem to think that that's what it's saying.
Your Honor,
in that case, doesn't help you.
Your Honor, what Corporal Bass takes from that case is that you're looking at the questioner, the teacher, and the declarant, the child. It's a test involving both, and that's the best way to harmonize the Supreme Court jurisprudence on this issue.
Counsel, could you turn to the issue of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
You had trial counsel here during closing arguments saying that it's just a small piece of the puzzle, saying that you really don't need this, members of the panel, to decide this case, saying that the case did not rise or fall in the testimony. Should we consider that?
Well, Your Honor, that's blasted out by just the jet engine, if you will, of the fact that a rectal swab from the alleged victim of sexual abuse, where anal penetration is at issue based on the messages, tested positive for gonorrhea. The government in opening did not minimize that. The government's witnesses, Special Agent Morgan and Dr. Kafer, tested flat out that GB was positive for gonorrhea without any caveats about the lack of confirmatory testing or anything like that.
What about the jet engine of the Skype chats? In other words, didn't the government have extremely compelling evidence here? You've got the Skype chats. You've got this imaginary figure. You've got one of the Skype chats lasting for 40 minutes, and the theory of the defense is that they were really doing this to a teddy bear. So 40 minutes of Skype chats with obscene conduct being inflicted on a teddy bear. It would seem that panel members would not be tend to be overwhelmed by the defense argument here, but instead would be overwhelmed by the compelling nature of the government argument, wouldn't they?
Your Honor, if that were the case, there would have been convictions across the board. You had messages on the 2nd of May that were no less vulgar and inflammatory than the messages on 29 March and 15 May, but for the fact that the two dates of conviction could be read to involve anal penetration.
Well, in that regard, didn't the results of the test come after the March 2nd incident?
Your Honor, the...
So if they were steamrollered by the results of the test, how is that so with the March 2nd incident?
Your Honor, the test results came in May, but the members heard that from Dr. Macedonia that gonorrhea can not reveal itself for a long time. You have Corporal Bass saying that he tested positive one, maybe 2 months ago. You have room under the harmless beyond reasonable doubt standard. The government can't prove that it didn't influence the findings. Briefly on the second issue, on the Daubert issue, the military judge reached a decision outside the range of choices reasonably arising from the applicable facts and law on the first, second, and third Daubert factors. The case United States v. Hill shows that a preliminary test there that was luminol for the presence of blood cannot be admitted as conclusive proof at trial of a fact. Here you have the government treating this as proof that GB has gonorrhea when the Centers for Disease Control and Dietherics itself admit that this is only the invitation for further testing by culture, which would have produced a 100% accurate result. And as far as reliability goes, this court in Henning counseled that if a test can't show whether a condition is more likely to be present or not, it should not be admitted, and that's not the case here where the positive predictive value was low. See, I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Joshua Fiveson, along with Lieutenant Colonel Nicholas Gannon. I represent the United States. This court should affirm for two reasons. First, the military judge properly introduced the dietherics report as a business record, which does not and has never implicated the Confrontation Clause. And second, Daubert does not govern the admission of physical evidence as a matter of law, and as a matter of fact, it did not in this case. For that reason, appellant's second granted issue is moot. To the first issue, this court, as well as the Supreme Court, across the entire spectrum of cases in this arena, has principally looked to three questions in determining whether or not a statement is testimonial. Who, what, and why? Each of these counsels to a single resolution in this case, which is that the dietherics report was not testimonial. As the Supreme Court unanimously stated most recently in Ohio versus Clark, quote, a statement cannot fall within the Confrontation Clause unless its primary purpose was testimonial. We are not here confronted with such a statement. In the first category, who was the statement made by? Here, dietherics, an independent laboratory on request of a private pediatrician. Dietherics was a non-forensic laboratory which had previously worked with this pediatrician's office in the past to provide medical services. Even more, dietherics testified that they had no idea that this report would be used in a forensic context. And just as the Supreme Court has recognized again in Clark as clear that statements between a child and teacher are fundamentally unlike those between a citizen and law enforcement, so too between an independent laboratory and a private pediatrician. Now, who solicited the statement? Contrary to my colleague's suggestion, this was solicited by a doctor for a medical purpose. There is no evidence to indicate that law enforcement solicited or requested this test. In fact, law enforcement testified explicitly otherwise. Law enforcement stated that they did not, quote, order or request the test. And in fact, when law enforcement first met with Mrs. Bass, the appointment with the pediatrician had already been set up.
Counsel, how do you respond to counsel for the appellant's argument that the test did not serve a medical purpose because they could have just given antibiotics and they didn't need to determine whether it was gonorrhea?
Your Honor, I would respond simply that I'm not a doctor. And here we have testimony from the doctor who stated specifically that she, quote, ordered the test for medical purposes. So to the extent that the doctor believed it necessary, that speaks to its clear primary purpose. And though other cases may have involved a prophylactic administration of antibiotics, we here on this record have been presented with a clear primary purpose where the doctor thought it necessary to first seek a test before, as you recognize, Judge Olson, administering antibiotics to a very small child. Now, to the extent that appellant suggests the social worker is somehow an arm of law enforcement, that much is neither supported on this record nor in any precedent. Social workers have not been categorically deputized as arms of law enforcement, and here the record reflects that social services was independently involved in the situation, received an independent report, and that's actually at Joint Appendix 113. Here, Mrs. Fannensteel further testified that her job was to, quote, create a care plan, and that's exactly what happened. And further, to the extent that Supreme Court precedent has recognized folks outside of the realm of law enforcement, for example, in Davis, the 911 operator, there can be no closer adjunct of law enforcement than a 911 operator. But in that case, the Supreme Court recognized still there are circumstances that are afield from a law enforcement function. And here, this Court is presented with an even simpler case because there is no evidence that law enforcement coordinated with social services, and we are left with a, quote, reasonable assumption. But it's the United States' position that that assumption is neither reasonable nor warranted here. Now to the what. Diatherics report was a non-forensic screening test that was requested for medical purposes. It collected objective facts, much like the forgery affidavit in United States versus Forrester that this court confronted, albeit in a pre-Crawford era. But the analysis is nonetheless the same. In that case, there was an objective collection of facts, namely the account that was used, the amount of funds that was taken, and the reason that affidavit, literal affidavit, was solicited was because the bank wanted to render services to a client, just as Dr. Kafer here was attempting and in fact did render services to her child patient. Now, to the third category, which is why, arguably the most important category, the Supreme Court has made clear in Melendez-Diaz that medical reports created for treatment are not testimonial. And we are presented with that exact same circumstance. Dr. Kafer ordered the test, quote, for health reasons, not investigation. The pediatrician, Dr. Kafer, further testified that the reason she used the diatherics test was because it was a, quote, excellent screening test, and that during the course of treatment that she had previously provided to other patients in similar circumstances. And most importantly, when the results returned from diatherics, Dr. Kafer did not contact law enforcement. Dr. Kafer did not request retesting by diatherics, nor did Dr. Kafer request preservation.
Was it a good test or a lousy test?
Your Honor.
You just said she testified that it was a very good screening test. And earlier we hear this stuff thrown around about how it was really a terrible test and totally unsuited for the purpose. What is it?
Your Honor, in the words of Dr. Kafer, it was an excellent screening test.
Okay, it's a good test.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Now, there was no preservation requested by diatherics, and I'd like to correct one point that was initially made, that diatherics would have done nothing different if they knew that this was going to be used in the forensic context. Not completely accurate. In fact, diatherics testified that had they been requested to create a chain of custody, they could have done so. But the point is, diatherics as a laboratory, as a corpus, is simply a non-forensic organization, completely unlike all of the cases on which appellant relies. In fact, almost all of the cases cited involve state-run forensic laboratories on request by law enforcement. That is fundamentally different than the situation here. I'd also like to briefly address, essentially, appellant's argument reduces to the notion that because this was very incriminating, it must have been testimonial. That much has been rejected by the Supreme Court in Clark, as well as this court, across virtually every case in this space, to include Forrester. And even more, Rankin, as well as Clark, focused on not on the foreseeability, but simply the primary purpose. Because again, quote, a statement cannot fall within the Confrontation Clause unless its primary purpose was testimonial. Now, this is echoed in the actual means of admission here as a business record. Business records, since the founding, have not been subject to the Confrontation Clause. Neither Crawford nor any of the cases it's produced have mounted any evidence, as in the Supreme Court's words, that required exclusion of evidence that was regularly admitted at the founding. Now, I'd like to be clear, this does not suggest, and it's not the United States' position, that the federal rules of evidence somehow contour the effect or application of the Constitution, quite otherwise. This recognizes the innate nature of business records that has been spoken of not only in Clark, but in Crawford, in Bryant, in Palmer, as well as this court. In fact, Judge Ryan, as you recognized in your concurrence in Hargrow, evidence that is created with an eye toward trial does not qualify as a business record, which is, of course, consistent with the Supreme Court's case law in this space. And to the
counsel, if it's coming in as a business record, there still needs to be a trustworthiness determination, doesn't there?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
In this instance, didn't the military judge conduct that trustworthy determination in the Daubert context?
Your Honor, the Daubert hearing was held about a month before trial. At that point, nobody knew that the government was going to admit this as a business record, which speaks to why the second granted issue is moot. But to your point, Your Honor, the 8036 echo places the burden for challenging trustworthiness on the opponent of the evidence. And here, when the evidence was actually offered and then admitted as a business record, there was no such objection. The only objections were to relevance, reliability, 403, foundation, and the Confrontation Clause. So to the extent that it is appellant's burden, at least at trial, then the accused, burden to challenge, it simply wasn't done here.
Argument is that the military judge's Daubert analysis is moot. But wasn't the military judge looking at this trustworthiness issue, regardless of who bore the burden? Didn't the military judge engage in that analysis through a Daubert, in a Daubert context?
We would concede, Your Honor, that the analysis would look a lot like a Daubert hearing. Yes, Your Honor. But when the hearing was being conducted, it of course wasn't contemplated that this would later be admitted as a business record. But at the point of analysis on the record after the United States offered and admitted the business record, appellant's only challenge was to 403, among the others that I've already enumerated. And in that respect, the military judge said, as I've already recognized, 403 is fine. So to the extent that the Daubert hearing presaged a lot of the thought that happened later, the 403 analysis is really the only one that would be relevant to consider.
Didn't the trial counsel at the time of the trial agree that the Daubert analysis was appropriate? Engaging in it, not necessarily how the military judge actually conducted it.
Yes, Your Honor. The United States engaged in the Daubert hearing, of course.
So what should we make of that, that trial counsel at the time of trial said a Daubert analysis was appropriate? Why should we at this level now say it was moot?
I would offer 2 points, or 3 points in response, Your Honor. First, the United States did not offer a position on admissibility. The United States took a position on why appellant's motion for exclusion should be overruled. And though similar, those two are notably distinct. Second, to the extent that this discussion invokes law of the case, perhaps, at least appellant has raised as much, law of the case cannot change the facts of the case. And here, notwithstanding any potential confusion that may have infused the Daubert hearing, and I stress potential, the fact is, a month later, during trial, the United States offered and admitted this business record as a business record, and that controls here. So, again, law of the case cannot change the facts of and the actual basis.
Is it your position that even if it didn't meet the Daubert factors, that it could be admitted as a business record? I mean, what's the problem? Do you have a problem with the military judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law in the Daubert hearing?
No, not at all, Your Honor. And to the extent that I suggest as much, I apologize. The Daubert hearing was properly conducted, and the military judge applied the factors and ruled within his reasonable options, within his reasonable choices. My point is only that the Daubert hearing is completely separate from the actual basis for admission here. When the United States offered Prosecution Exhibit 4, it did so as a business record, and that is why.
I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think Judge Olson's point is that if it didn't qualify as a reliable test, it couldn't be admitted as a business record, right? You can't slip in unreliable scientific evidence as a business record.
Yes, Your Honor. We would, of course, agree with that. Though the analyses are somewhat different, in the context of a business record, typically the analysis focuses on an external third party and their practices, which are therein reflective of the reliability. So it's not a full-on Daubert hearing, but the two certainly get to the same sentiment, which is, yes, this was reliable because the business regularly used this type of information, did so in the medical context, recognizing the gravity of the situation, and kept that record during the course of ordinary business.
So if we're analyzing the military judge's analysis under Daubert, abuse of discretion applies, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So one of the factors is whether it was peer-reviewed, and the military judge concluded that it was. But there's no indication that this was, in fact, peer-reviewed. And furthermore, there's indication that it wasn't certainly peer-reviewed in the context of having this done for pediatric patients rectally on boys. So how is that judge's finding correct in that context?
Yes, Your Honor. I have 2 points that I would offer. First, of course, it's the United States' position that the Daubert hearing and the ruling are moot because, again, this was offered as a business record completely apart from the Daubert ruling. That was a motion in limine to exclude, not the pre-admission of evidence. But more directly to your question, Your Honor, as Daubert itself recognized, publication in journals is not essential and does not, quote, necessarily correlate with reliability. But to the point that other NATs in this context had been peer-reviewed, the military judge was simply saying that the underlying science here, NATs in general, had been peer-reviewed. And that is unlike appellant's characterization that this is a Henning situation involving two formulae that were simply incompatible with one another. Here, the military judge recognized that there was not a lot of study of this procedure, but simultaneously pointed out and correctly observed that the science underlying this procedure had been peer-reviewed.
But if you look at those same issues that I just raised in the context of peer review, and look at that in the context of maintenance of standards, which was another factor that the military judge considered and ruled in favor of the government, how were the standards maintained when with that test, that specific test, it's not supposed to be used on boys, not supposed to be used on infants, not supposed to be used rectally to determine whether there was gonorrhea. How were the standards maintained?
Your Honor, those are certainly considerations that would make this a close call for a military judge. Ultimately, the military judge, correctly considering that Daubert factor, exercised his discretion and concluded that ultimately this weighed in favor of the government. It may have been a close call, but the ultimate conclusion, viewed together with all of the Daubert factors, weighed in favor of admission here. And again, as this court has routinely held, a military judge is entitled to significant discretion in this context as long as they've applied the Daubert factors and the ruling is not manifestly erroneous.
Counsel, can you help me with sort of a basic question, which is that if Daubert doesn't apply to business records that contain scientific conclusions, how are those conclusions relevant? I mean, how can it be relevant unless we know that the test that – I mean, it might be a regularly maintained record and fit all the other requirements for the business record exclusion, but unless there is a scientific basis, then how would it be relevant? And if we have to have a scientific basis, why wouldn't Daubert be the test to use?
Your Honor, you've hit on 2 important points, which is first, the analysis may ultimately look similar when properly challenged here. The United States' point is simply that appellant's granted issue, as well as the principal arguments, is that the military abused his discretion in the Daubert hearing. that simply does not apply to the admission of evidence because the two were separate hearings. But a second point to your question, Your Honor, you've hit on exactly the correct challenge to make in this context, which is potentially reliability and 403. Though there are more compelling arguments that perhaps could have been made at the trial level, the fact is appellant didn't make those arguments. Appellant did not suggest perhaps that the probative value is minimal where there is no expert to explain the situation, or any number of arguments perhaps more directly in the vein of relevance. But here, those challenges were not made. It was just a blanket 401, 403 challenge, and the military judge, properly considering the legal framework for those challenges, decided against them.
Just so that I'm clear, the government let the defense know that it intended to admit the report, correct or incorrect?
That I am unsure of...
And then the defense moved for appropriate relief, meaning to suppress the report.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. So the defense...
And then the military judge did a Daubert hearing, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And said, yes, there might be some problems, but that goes to the weight that the members can give it, not the admissibility.
Yes
or no?
Yes.
And then the report was admitted.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would just caveat right there. A month later, the report was admitted on a completely different basis. The United States did not say, consistent with the Daubert hearing, we are now moving to admit. The United States offered it as the dietetics report, as a business record.
Well, it doesn't matter what basis they admitted it on. I mean, it's still a scientific record that the defense tried to keep out on the basis of unreliability, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
I guess I'm not understanding your argument.
Your Honor, the point is simply
what
that...
What difference does it make on what basis it was admitted?
The difference it makes is appellant's challenge is to the Daubert hearing and suggesting that the military judge abused his discretion during that hearing.
Well, and the result of that hearing was what? That you were allowed to admit the report?
Well, the result of that hearing, it's the military judge's ruling could certainly have been a bit more clear, but...
No, what I'm saying is if the military judge had ruled against you, you couldn't have admitted the report under any circumstance.
That may have been the case, Your Honor. That may have been the case, but the United States was not confronted with that. Sometimes evidence can be analyzed differently under different rubrics, and here there is a bit of a delta between the Daubert analysis and the business records analysis. But because the military judge correctly said that this was admissible under Daubert, there was no challenge with the ultimate admission as a business record. But the point, more simply, is that neither Daubert, nor Hauser, nor Henning, nor 702, I see that I'm almost out of time. If you wouldn't mind letting me finish this answer, Your Honor.
Do it.
None of those cases involved anything but testimony. And if the court takes a close look at appellant's actual motion at trial, the entirety of the law is the center of gravity is over testimony. The only phrase really that relates to evidence or the exclusion of the test itself in that ruling, or excuse me, in that motion, was the phrase testimony and evidence, which it's the United States' position has simply been an imprecise colloquialism that was originally drawn from Daubert.
I just think that you're making your life much more difficult than it needs to be, or you're making an argument that doesn't make any sense, right? You cannot, I hope you're not arguing that if the military judge had ruled against the government on Daubert, right, if they'd said, no, this is junk science, it can't come in, that you could have then admitted it as a business record?
No, Your Honor. If that had been the case, appellant would have very simply said, we are under 8036 ECHO, we are challenging its trustworthiness, and the military judge would have been correct to simply say, no, I'm not letting it in on the basis of trustworthiness. That did not happen here, and for that reason, appellant's second granted issue is moot, and the United States would ask that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
The military judge began his Daubert ruling by stating, defense moved the court to suppress the results of a nucleic acid amplification test. It was the plain understanding of the parties and the military judge at trial that the Daubert objection covered the results and any related testimony. Government's argument here that this is moot, first of all, there was expert testimony at trial by Dr. Hobbs for the government, which went far beyond the face of the statement in the lab report, which just said gonorrhea was detected in the sample. She specifically vouched that the sample was, in her mind, reasonably likely to indicate a true positive. And in addition to the law of the case, the government doesn't address numerous Supreme Court and military cases that pointedly say testimony or evidence. It does not make any sense as a colloquialism. The manual says that the military judge has discretion to apply Daubert to testimony or evidence, and there are sound reasons to distinguish between whether something was reliably done as a course of activity, as a business record, and whether what was done on a reoccurring basis is actually junk science or substantively reliable. Corporal Bass's example of phrenology goes unrefuted. Just because someone consistently and reliably measures, takes measurements of skull size and then they use that as a conclusion about character traits does not mean that there's any scientific merit to that. And government's proposed rule that they advance for the first time in this litigation would open the floodgates to pure junk science. As Your Honor pointed out, Judge Olson, the military judge abused his discretion here under Daubert. He made a completely erroneous finding on whether there was peer review here.
The military judge specifically said that this particular test had not been peer reviewed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then he went on to say that the underlying science of similar tests had been peer reviewed.
Yes, Your Honor, but that was not with respect to testing on prepubescent minors, which
But he acknowledged that.
Your Honor, it's an unreasonable conclusion under the prevailing law.
That's a different point than that he made incorrect statements.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. My apologies. But the test was simply not scientifically competent to make the claim that the military judge allowed it in evidence to make, which was that GB's rectal swab sample tested positive for gonorrhea. The experts here agreed that the prevalence of gonorrhea was so low, one in 1,000 in prepubescent minors, that the chances this was
Thank
a false...
goodness.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. But that means that the test was more likely than not to be a false positive in this case. That type of science should not be admissible in the felony general court-martial proceeding.
Is that a quirk of statistics or an actual... knock on the reliability of the test?
Your Honor,
it seems to be the former, because it's simply because the whole thing's so rare that any possible false positive bulks much larger than it otherwise would have as a matter of statistics. Not that I know anything about statistics.
That would be like saying, you know, only 1% of girls under the age of 10 are pregnant, therefore get pregnant, therefore the pregnancy test is unreliable.
Yeah.
Your Honor, I'm not sure about the science of a pregnancy test, whether that maps, but the...
But my point is that, like, yes, we would not expect to see a lot of 10-year-old girls being pregnant, but the fact that there aren't many, or the fact that not many young boys have gonorrhea, I mean, that's just a fact.
Your Honor, it is, but that's why in the scientifically valid approach, as the CDC says, you use a culture test, which has a 100% accuracy rate, it's actually taking the bacteria and growing it and can ascertain.
So there's a better test.
Yes, Your Honor, the culture test, which even the government expert admitted should have been done in this case, and with the gravity of what was at stake, not just giving someone a shot for antibiotics, whether someone was presented.
Okay, so now we're back to saying it's a lousy test.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
For Daubert purposes, it most certainly was.
Okay.
Regardless of what anyone thought. And for these reasons, this court should set aside the findings in the sentence in Corporal Bass's case.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:25.
Court is in recess.